Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, Stephen?
Excellent, man. I feel like I've dodged a bullet. I don't know about you, you know.
Well, now explain. How is that?
Well, you know, they fired up that particle accelerator over there in the Geneva area,
the Large Hadron Collider. That's right.
That's right.
It's up and running.
They fired it up and produced a bunch of little mini black holes, and none of them swallowed the Earth. So, yeah, that's awesome. That's cool. Maybe we can learn something and not die. That's always good.
You know, I think it's better if you learn something and not die, because then you have the opportunity to apply the lesson, you see.
That's exactly right.
if you die in the process of learning, okay, it's still valuable that you learn something. But well, I agree. The world has not ended, but, you know, that's just this one world, right?
Okay.
Lord knows what quantum disturbances they've caused with this thing. It's possible, on the other hand, that total quantum collapse was imminent. And we just prevented it, just in the nick of time, by getting a Large Hadron Collider.
So.
There's a lot of different ways of looking at it. You see that?
Yeah, there's mainly we don't want to look at it in a way that's neutral. It's either a great good or it's going to lead to utopia or it's going to lead to dystopia. One of the two. There's no possible middle ground at all. Is that correct?
What a fantastic introduction to our topic tonight. But actually, before we get into that, I think we got a couple other preliminary topics. And one thing I want to say is, as big news for us as getting the Large Hadron Collider going this week, I guess it's probably getting Fast Forward Radio going again this week.
Last week you had a bit of a power problem or power outage around your – was it your whole neighborhood or just what was going on?
Well, we were having a spring snowstorm, and as I was driving home, I observed that a street light was out right at the turnoff into our little subdivision, and I thought that to be a very bad sign, traffic light, I should say, because, you know, when the traffic lights go out, that you've got some serious electrical issues going on. And as I was driving through the neighborhood, I was looking for any sign of life in any of the windows in any of the houses, and I was like, nope. So got home, not surprised. We were completely without power, and actually, we were without power until right about the time the show starts. So even though I scrambled and canceled the show, we probably could have squeezed it in, but how could we have known that? You know, that's
exactly.
the thing is,
we put it off 1 week, and here we are. So there you go.
Here we are. Oh, and the other thing I should say is I had no power, so I had no internet, so I had no. I could get on my laptop, but I couldn't get on the internet, and my phone battery was almost dead. My iPhone. Otherwise, I could have done the show on my iPhone. So I guess the lesson learned is to keep the iPhone charged. So
I guess so. I'm actually doing it from the iPhone tonight. My landline is still buzzy, and I don't know what I'm going to do about that. I think I'm going to drop my landline. I'm finally ready. It's time. The landline's going because I just have no more use for it, particularly if it's going to sound like I'm calling from, you know, some remote village in the outback someplace.
Wherever.
If I can get as good a reception as I do with my iPhone, what's the point, you know? So
yeah, well, you sound great on the iPhone, that's for sure. And it's you know, the death of distance. It's interesting what's happening to the traditional plain old telephone service, POTS as we used to call it, working for the phone company. That that paradigm, I think, might we might see it just say bye-bye here before too long. I'm still using it. I'm on that technology right now because I found it to be superior to Skype, and I had performance problems using a VoIP provider. I tried a couple of those, and we always seem to run into issues. So the landline ended up being the best choice for me. But
yeah,
increasingly,
it has been for me, and so my phone line went weird on me. So yeah.
But increasingly, people are finding, well, my phone is the thing I carry around with me. It's not something tethered in place in my home, right? That's
exactly
the bottom line on phones. Okay, so before we jump into utopias and dystopias, I saw you put a blog post up on a movie. Let's check in on that real fast. Tell us about what is it? How to train a dragon?
How to train your dragon.
How to Train Your Dragon.
It's a great show for the kids, but I got to tell you, I had a good time. It was fun and funny. And the thing is, I don't know, DreamWorks is, I don't know if they're doing this on purpose or if it's just the nature of the people that are making movies for them, but I've noticed that they tend to pick up on a piece of geek culture and then kind of spin it into the plot of their movies. At least they did so with Kung Fu Panda,
mm-hmm.
and they did it again here with How to Train Your Dragon. With Kung Fu Panda, it was the Kung Fu cinema geeks, that kind of culture, worshiping these martial artists from afar, not really practicing the martial art, of course, but just, you know, thinking how awesome they are and knowing their every move and everything like that. That's Kung Fu cinema geeks, okay?
Right.
And with How to Train Your Dragon, it was a different sort of geeks. I think that it was really some of the gamer culture. Those who play role playing games and things like that. There's definitely some nods to it in there. But I mean, I guess the thing that made it fun was you got to hear a kid who is different from every other Viking who's around. He's not particularly physically imposing, and he likes to think through problems, and how does he function within this Viking culture that's all about being a big guy swinging a big axe, you know, to take care of dragons? And his solutions are pretty fun, and it was definitely a great movie. And
that sounds very cool.
So, yeah, so I recommend it highly.
All right. Well, we'll all have to check that out, and everyone look for Stephen's review on The Speculist. Although I think you pretty much reiterated everything from the review just now, but folks, go read The Speculist. Come on.
Every now and then, throw us a bone.
drop by. You know what the heck. you'll find some good stuff there. We promise. So let's talk a little utopia/dystopia, and we're 2 weeks out now, and I can't remember what led us to decide we wanted to devote an hour to this topic, but it is something that we come back to every now and then. I've observed, especially the fun dystopias that we encounter mostly in the movies, although there are some classic dystopias from the world of literature, for sure, and utopias, which I think get kind of a bad rep. I think that the word utopia is used usually disparagingly, and there is a misunderstanding of what a utopia is and what actually useful purpose it serves. So we'll get into that a little bit. But we'll start by talking about the original. And are you familiar with the origin of the word utopia? Who came up with that?
Well, yeah, actually I am. It was a book that came out in the 1500s, I think, right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah,
written by Sir Thomas More, or St. Thomas More, as he's also known, courtier from the court of Henry VIII. He was a big shot in Henry VIII's court prior to the separation of the Church of England from the Church of Rome. He of course ended up staying true to the Roman Catholic Church, thus the saint designation. But before all that happened, for fans of the Showtime series The Tudors, he's actually played by, oh, what's the guy's name? Sam Neill on that show, I believe.
Love that actor. Yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome. So Thomas More wrote a book called Utopia, and basically he made the word up. He just actually took two Greek words and fused them together, and it's Greek for no place. So he took some ideas from Plato's Republic, and he described what some have taken to be the perfect society. And so in Utopia, as described by St. Thomas More, everyone lives in equality. There's no private property. Poverty doesn't exist. Most human misery has been eliminated. There's religious tolerance. There's few laws, and there's no lawyers, Stephen. So I'm just telling you. And citizens rarely are called upon to go to war. And it's interesting. In fact, when they do go to war, they usually hire mercenaries to fight their wars for them, because the utopians themselves don't have to engage
dirty their hands. Yeah,
exactly. Armed conflict, because they don't believe in that. So one of the things that I learned, I had actually read Utopia in college. And one of the things that I learned today, reading back up on it, or that I had just not remembered, was that there's actually quite a debate about whether Moore was giving an outline of the perfect society, or if he was just kind of giving a critique of Renaissance England. The book may have been more like Gulliver's Travels, which was written by Swift, as just all the countries that Gulliver goes to, Lilliput and Brobdingnag and all these amazing places that he goes to, they're all just like send-ups of various aspects of British and European culture during the Renaissance period. So it's possible that that Moore wasn't really even saying, "Hey, this is the way we ought to design the world." And there's some good evidence that probably he wasn't saying that. For example, he was obviously a devout Catholic, but in Utopia they had married priests, they had women priests, they allowed divorce. In Utopia there were no lawyers, but Thomas More was like one of the most prolific and powerful lawyers in all of England. So it's interesting that he would write a book that says, in your perfect society, you don't have one. So it's possible that he was writing it in a kind of a tongue-in-cheek way, saying, look, everyone, the perfect society, and that the joke is really kind of on those who take it as the perfect society. In fact, he was offering a mirror image of Henry's England, and doing it kind of indirectly, so that you're not, you don't want to go too hard on the king, obviously.
Right.
So that's an interesting.
You
want to
stick around, yeah.
Yeah, which of course in the end he did not, but that was over other issues. So it's interesting that we take the concept of the perfect world, and it's given to us originally in something that may not even have been going in that direction at all. But now the word definitely means that. When people say utopia, well, give me your definition, Stephen. What's a utopia?
Well, I just wanted to point out that the very fact that his word, utopia, means nowhere or no place, I think that sort of clues us in as to what St. Thomas More was saying. I think he was saying, yeah, this is it. Isn't this great? But it's not really achievable. I don't think.
Yeah, it's not a real place. Yeah, exactly. Entirely possible.
Yeah. I kind of get that from the way he came up with the word, but what was your question just then? So I'm sorry.
In common parlance, what does utopia mean? If someone says that, if someone tells you that someone else's ideas are utopian, what does that suggest?
Well, I think it sometimes has a very negative connotation. I think that.
Okay. I think so too.
I think in the minds of many, if somebody is called a utopian, that's basically saying that they're being naive. They're bringing up things that really wouldn't work in the real world, And one of the things I think that utopians often forget is the needs for humans to achieve, to be able to go out and do this or that and be rewarded for their efforts. I think a lot of utopians forget that, and so. I think when people say utopian in a negative way, I think that's maybe part of it. That's one of the ways you can be a utopian and not quite get it,
Yeah, I think that the word utopian probably has a lot in common with the another slur on optimistic outlooks is when you're called a Pollyanna, right? Which is which is to suggest that you have a just ridiculously unrealistic view of what the future is going to be, and you know, like an irritatingly sunny outlook on where the world's going. In the case of a Pollyanna, but yeah, a utopian is I think in common parlance that means someone who has this highly idealized view of what the future could be or what the world ought to be like, and that it's highly disconnected from reality. I think those are the those are kind of the two.
And I think that's a definition that St. Thomas More would find appropriate based on, you know, how I think I would interpret his work. But, you know,
it's possible. It could be. Yeah. It could be that that the man who invented utopia was himself no utopian and would have had a very dour view on the whole enterprise. Now, I got a few categories of utopias. This is interesting. I actually, from the Wikipedia article, so you know that this is solid information that you can all take home and study. But I thought it was interesting the way they divided it up. They provided several different categories of utopias. One is ecological, one was political, and one was religious, before we get to the kind that we're more closely associated with here at the Speculus. But some interesting examples of the ecological utopias. Henry David Thoreau wrote Walden, and then I guess in the previous century, in the 20th century, B.F. Skinner wrote Walden 2. And there's an interesting novel called Island by Aldous Huxley, who also wrote Brave New World, which is kind of his sequel, almost sort of his answer to Brave New World. He did a, I don't know, maybe less brave, less new world called Island. And this was a future where some of the same ideas appeared, but it was toned down quite a bit. But there was this real emphasis on kind of getting back to nature. And one of the things, you know, to your point earlier about people needing to do something, he had this idea of a real happy medium of selective use of technology, not the total rejection of technology that you would see in the people who just want to go back to an agrarian lifestyle and, you know, the Amish kind of approach to the world, and not the just wholehearted hog wild acceptance of the technology that people like us have, right? He had this idea of there's some technology that's really going to be cool and is really going to work for us, and some that we're better off without. But what's really important is that people are close to the land and that they have work that's in the land. That's, you know, it's kind of a real hippie kind of a model. But I think it's interesting that as people have worked on the utopian idea over the years, they've tried to correct some of the crazy directions it goes in. For example, if there have been those who have said you need to reject all technology, Aldous Huxley comes back and goes, oh, well, maybe not. Maybe you just reject some of it. I thought it was interesting to note that these ecological utopias, they usually involve a rejection of industrial society, and they talk about a return to a clean, primitive state. So it occurred to me that a recent movie that we've discussed quite heavily on this program had an example of an ecological utopia in it. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Well, remind me. I'm sorry.
Well, Avatar, right? The
I'm sorry.
The Na'vi lived in an ecological utopia. They were one with the land, and they had valuable things to do. But it wasn't an Aldous Huxley style, because there was no true technology there, unless you go with my theory, which is that the whole planet has to be the product of some impressive biotech, and that the people who originally designed it are long gone. But you see a lot of ecological utopian ideas in the environmental movement. And I think that ideas from the environmental movement, when they get translated into fiction, end up taking that kind of shape. So that's one kind, the ecological utopia. Then there's the political utopia. And some interesting examples were given there. I've read some William Morris, and I know he was kind of this 19th century socialist visionary of what the world would be like. But I hadn't heard too much about Edward Bellamy, and I guess in his day, this guy was huge. I guess he was like the Stephen King of his day. He wrote the third biggest bestseller of the 19th century. It was, oh gosh, now I can't remember, Uncle Tom's Cabin, something else, and then this guy's book, Looking Backward. And it was written in 1887, and he predicted, basically described the world in the year 2000, one of these stories where somebody falls asleep in 1887 and he wakes up and it's the year 2000.
Yep.
And in the year 2000 in Boston, the United States is this socialist utopia. Really interesting ideas that he introduced that did come to pass are credit cards. He predicts credit cards in the book. And he predicts these big warehouses where people go to get their stuff. And apparently the sections in the book sound alarmingly like Costco or Sam's Club or something like that. But the difference being it's not a market economy. It's this people have earned credits by being good or, I don't know, by being valuable members of society or something like that. So they can go to the warehouse and get their stuff. But everybody eats together in these communal dining halls. And he has this really sweeping vision of the perfect society, very much in line with what Thomas More may or may not have been doing, right? But certainly Edward Bellamy would have said, yes, he gave a blueprint for a perfect society. Now, here is my, you know, this guy's not kidding, right, when he writes his book. This is not a joke. This is a blueprint for a perfect society. One of the things I was really interested to read, I guess there were a number of these kinds of things written back in the mid to late 19th century. Most of the a number of the early kind of science fiction romances, as they called them at the time, that were written had this utopian and often kind of left-leaning socialist angle to them. And apparently the real political movement, the socialist movement, got really fed up with utopianism, and I guess Marx was really down on utopianism. He was a harsh critic of the notion of utopia, in some ways very much a modern kind of criticism of utopia, the kind of things that we were just saying about it, right, that it's not realistic, it's not grounded in what's really likely to happen. So for quite some time, the utopian ideal was at least attempted to be divorced from the political movement, although we'll come back to the relationship between utopias and politics in a few moments. And then the greatest example I saw in literature of a political utopia, and I had never thought of it in these terms at all, I assume you've read The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it's a free market libertarian utopia. I had never thought of it in those terms, but that's exactly what it is. It's a utopia that swings the other way. Instead of being a utopia that says, here's a blueprint for a perfect society, there's no private property, everybody owns anything, in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, you get the blueprint, and it's the perfect free market society. In fact, another book he wrote, one of his juveniles, is a book called Podcane of Mars. I don't suppose you're familiar with that one by any chance.
No, I didn't read any of his juveniles.
Oh. Hey, you got to get the boys going on these juveniles, man. These books are awesome. I know they're like 60 years out of date in the technology as a joke, but a lot of great philosophy in these books. In Podcane of Mars, the society on Venus, I think, is very much similar to what you see on the moon in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And I don't know which of those two books were written first, but as I look back on having read that juvenile book as a kid, that I think a lot of my ideas about, wow, this would be an interesting way to structure society, I started thinking about by reading this very odd corporate sort of society that they had on Venus in Podcane of Mars. Basically, the entire planet was just like a resort. There was a corporation that collected, money from people doing things, and they owned the mines or something like that. But other than that, it was do what you want, more of a kind of a libertine, almost maybe a dystopia, actually, philosophy. But I just think it's really interesting that Robert Heinlein was experimenting with different ideas of what a blueprint for a perfect or even an imperfect society might be, and he came up with a completely different model of a utopia in the Moon is a Harsh Mistress. But let me throw this one back to you. Did you ever think of that story as utopian?
Moon is a Harsh Mistress? No, I didn't.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay.
I never considered it that way at all. Now, the thing is, any vision of the future is liable to be dystopic in some, you know, dystopic in some way. I guess is the right way to pronounce that, or you know, or utopian. If you think about it, I mean, Star Trek obviously has utopian ideas, but many and probably most of our movies about the future are going to be dystopias. They're going to have, you know, here's what's happening today. Let's extrapolate that out a few years and see how the world could just really go to pot based on how things are going right now. And that's what we often see in science fiction. So,
yeah, absolutely. I think that when you swing it around to the idea of dystopias, and we'll get to those in just a minute. Largely, dystopian ideas they come down to, here's what's wrong with your utopia, bub. Okay, here's where your utopia is really going to lead us. All right,
it's the utopia with a fatal flaw. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you try out your utopia, and here's what's going to happen to all of us. Yeah, I agree completely. That's the way most of that literature is functions. But have you ever noticed, though, one man's dystopia is another man's utopia? I mean, within these movies, at least, there's always somebody that's perfectly happy with the way things are. You know, they've done pretty well for themselves within the within the dystopia. You know, there's anti-entity, you know, in the last Mad Max movie. You know, she's basically the queen of that little, you know, barter town. Of course, she has to deal with Master Blaster, but aside from a few problems like that, you know, she's got it pretty good, and she's happy with the way things are, and really looks back on her former life as a bit boring. Where you see the same type character in the movie The Postman, where you know, the main bad guy is he looks back on his former existence as a photocopy machine salesman and says, what a waste that life was. Well, of course, he's a tyrant, but he happens to like being a tyrant. So I guess
keeping it within the Mad Max universe for a moment, go back to the Road Warrior. Yeah. How exciting do you suppose the Lord Humongous's life was really before the big collapse? Right? I mean, I don't think he had the minions and the whole thing going on before. Yeah, it's a good point.
Minions,
I mean,
minions are fun, so you know.
It's good to be king. It's nice to have minions. So that's an interesting way of looking at it. The dystopia usually has somebody on top who's really enjoying the fact that it's that things have turned out the way they have, and who wouldn't want a happy ending to the story because they've got it pretty good based on being the people on top of the miserable heap, as it were.
I guess so. Well, you know, there's a Ronald Reagan quote that somehow applies. It's, you know, when a neighbor loses his job, that's a recession. When I lose my job, it's a depression. You know, so, I guess it comes down to, you know, try to always be at the top of the heap, I guess is what I'm saying.
You always want to be at the top of the heap, absolutely. So anyway, they listed some other kinds of utopias, religious. They talked about the Shakers, the Harmony Society, interesting groups. The 19th century was huge for utopian ideas. I don't think there's ever been such a utopian promoting period in human history as the 19th century. You had socialism coming into existence. You had you had science fiction really sort of coming into its own, and people beginning to write these vast visions of the future. And then you had these religious groups like the Shakers. It's interesting. They even talk about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as being one of these 19th century utopian movements. And there's an interesting quote in the Wikipedia article where Peter F. Drucker says that Mormons are the only utopia that ever worked. So I think that's really interesting. You could argue all day long about whether or not they're a utopia, but they certainly are successful. And if they were in some sense a utopian movement to begin with, you would have to give that church credit for being one of the most successful utopian movements ever.
I think that they were successful in that they moved from being a utopian movement into sort of a mainstream religious movement. I think that's how they were successful. I don't think that if everyone living in Salt Lake City is you know, feels like they're living in a utopia.
Interesting. And that's probably true. You see, some of those groups from that time were able to make that shift. Seventh-day Adventists, I think, were sort of the same way. That started out as kind of a utopian group that made it more or less into the mainstream. The ones that couldn't make the
leap,
that transition, that had to remain utopians. How many Shakers do you see around, you know, your neighborhood? We don't have any Shaker communities.
There's a qualifying thing. In order to be a Shaker, you pretty much have to basically give up sex. And so that, you know, come join our movement. We don't have sex. That's a hard recruitment to make. And so there's your problem right there.
Perhaps it wasn't just the utopianism. All right.
I'm thinking, number one, you're not producing little Shakers because you're not having sex.
The only way to get new Shakers would be to convert from other people who are still reproducing. It's true.
Yeah, and so, come join us. We don't have sex. It's just, for most people, that's just not gonna fly. So, yeah, a lot of those groups died out for one reason or another, but that was a big one.
I want to say I don't know for sure, but I doubt that any of their promotional material actually had that line.
I suspect you're right, but...
Speaking as a marketing person, I would have to say that's a bad way to try to sell it. Okay.
They didn't lead with that. That was sort of the once you're already in. Well,
yeah.
By
once
the
you're
way.
In. Oh, by the way. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So finally, we come to the sort that we talk about here, and that would be the science and technology driven utopias. And I'm just going to read a little bit right out of the Wikipedia article because I thought it was really interesting. They said, scientific and technological utopias are set in the future when it is believed that advanced science and technology will allow utopian living standards, for example, the absence of death and suffering, changes in human nature and the human condition. Technology has affected the way humans have lived to such an extent that normal functions like sleep, eating, or even reproduction have been replaced by artificial means. Uh-oh, starting to sound a little Shaker there. Other examples include a society where humans have struck a balance with technology, and it is merely used to enhance the human living condition, and they give the example of Star Trek. In place of the static perfection of a utopia, libertarian transhumanists envision an extropia, an open, evolving society, allowing individuals and voluntary groupings to form the institutions and social forms they prefer. Buckminster Fuller presented a theoretical basis for technological utopianism, and set out to develop a variety of technologies ranging from maps to designs for cars and houses, which might lead to the development of such a utopia. I think it's important to remember that Buckminster Fuller was kind of a leading light towards a lot of what we talk about on this program today. He put some really interesting ideas in play for a guy who was working on these issues back in the middle part of the previous century. What do you think of that breakdown? Is that a fair assessment of technological, scientific, and technological utopians?
Absolutely, and I know right where I fall in that in that setup there. I would consider myself a libertarian utopian. You know, to me, the quickest way to get to a dystopia is for there to be a centrally planned utopia.
Interesting.
I believe that if you allow society to evolve as it is, we have a better shot at everyone having an opportunity at happiness, to pursue their own happiness, than if you got a set of elite from a central location planning here's what's best for you, society, here's what you need, and then basically ruling from on high on that score. I just don't think that that's a good way to get to your utopia.
I love the idea of extropia, an open, evolving society allowing individuals and voluntary groupings to form the institutions and social forms they prefer. To me, that is one of the most positive and open views possible of the future, to think that there's not necessarily one right answer, and that in the future we might see people attempting to implement these kind of socialist ideas of utopia right next to a moon is a harsh mistress kind of society being put in place, that people will actually get to try a lot of different things. And I think that I think it'll be interesting to see what works and in what combinations. I certainly agree with you that up to this point in history, all the evidence is on the side of all the evidence is against central planning. Put it that way. That to date, here in the early 21st century, I don't think anyone can give a good example of when central planning an economy or trying to central plan a society has worked out very well. And the 20th century, in particular, is full of horror stories of people trying to do it, and utopias turning into dystopias. That's the story of the Soviet Union. It's the story of China up to the point of the Cultural Revolution and up until they kind of turned the corner and started doing things a little bit differently. I think all of the kind of totalitarian, idealistic regimes that we see in the middle part of the 20th century, they all had that core idea of a centrally planned society, and never worked. It's not an idea that has worked. It's an idea that has limited people's freedom. It's an idea that has shortened their lives, taken away their wealth, and given nothing in return other than from your earlier example, a few people at the top of the dystopia, had a really good time while it lasted.
And the anti-entities always do well, but the rest of us schmucks, are having a problem with it. And
although, did I ever tell you, when I was in, sorry to interrupt you, when I was in Nizhny Novgorod in Russia in 1993, this was one of the closed cities in the Soviet Union. Even Russians couldn't go there under the Soviet system unless they had a special stamp on their passport. Okay, so this was like interior Soviet Union. And because we were like big shot business people, they put us up in the finest hotel in town where only party officials normally would have stayed back, a couple years ago when it was still the Soviet Union. So
yeah.
This is the life of the, Riley, okay? This is the people on the top of the heap, right?
Okay.
And that place was a pit, okay? I mean,
yeah.
It was like, wow, really? This is it? Party officials? Oh, my Lord. And you try to get your head around what the normal schmoes had to, had to put up with, and it was a scary thought.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I don't know. I was going to make some kind of transition into the, stating that I think that this country was founded with the idea that, with some utopian ideas were involved. I mean, these our founding fathers were often very much part of the Enlightenment movement, and I think that they basically were looking at it and saying, well, let's allow people to, as much freedom as possible to pursue their own ends. And then later Thomas Jefferson, when he was founding the University of Virginia, he said, basically, this institution will be based on the pursuit of the truth. Wherever that truth may lead us, we will not be afraid to see it. That's sort of the marketplace of ideas. We're gonna allow everybody to say whatever you like, and then, whatever memes or ideas take hold, it'll be because they are the best ideas. In the competition of ideas, the best will win, and then we have a better shot of us all being happier because we have allowed, we don't dictate from on high what the ideas are that we're going to live by, and we don't dictate from on high here's how you must live, I think that's kind of, and I think that's been the basis for our strength as a nation for since the beginning. So anyway, there's my political spiel tonight.
Okay, well, nicely done. I agree. I think that the utopian ideal of individual freedom, okay, that is probably my one absolute ideological principle. I guess that I don't see how I could ever waver on. When these discussions get going about, well, you've got to have private property? I'm like, well, yeah, right now, certainly. In this world, you do. I don't know how it necessarily would work if we're all in a post-singularity virtual world. The private property might seem completely different. You know, or you've got to have the right to keep and bear arms. Well, yeah, but right now, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It might look different then. But there's one thing, which is, you know, the right of the conscience of the individual, the right of the individual to think his or her own thoughts, to pursue his or her own destiny, right? Not to have someone else telling you what your life is supposed to be. I think that is like the fundamental ideal of America that I certainly hope finds its way into whatever future we look for. And when I describe myself as an unapologetic utopian, I think it's more around that ideal than anything else. Because swinging it back just for a moment to central planning, which we've agreed has a perfect track record of utter failure, right? The reason I don't completely close the door on central planning for the future is that I know that there is this idea of the singleton. If a friendly AI comes along and it's operating a million times faster than us, and it's truly friendly and truly good, and we decide that we'll let it decide how things ought to work, that might, in the end, be a form of central planning that works. That would be very different from other forms of central planning that have been tried, and I'm not saying that I'm completely sold on that idea, that I don't have some reservations about that idea. I just throw that out there as a possible future iteration of central planning that could possibly work somewhere down the road. So that's why I always get hesitant about applying to the future everything that we've observed in the past. I think that utopias and dystopias work better in the rearview mirror, actually, than they do in the than they do looking forward. They're a little bit easier to spot once they've either arrived or once they've run their course. This is the thing I say is that we actually live in a relative utopia compared to our primitive ancestors, just in terms of the food we eat and the shelter we live in and the clothing we enjoy and the entertainment that's available to us and you know all the wonderful stuff that goes on in our life. We don't see this as utopia, but if you showed it to them, right, they would view this as like,
again, one man's utopia. I mean,
yeah,
we see all the problems. It's our dystopia. But you talk to somebody from North Korea and you show them our life, you know,
exactly.
They would be amazed. But anyway, there was a funny portion. Well, Jerry Seinfeld had it in one of his latest stand-ups. He basically had this observation. He says, you know, at what point in the future is the decision made that, you know, that's it, no more fashion of any sort, we're all going to the silver jumpsuits, you know? I mean, how is that decision made, you know? I mean, it's at what point? And my thought on, you know, the no private property, about the time that we all adopt the silver jumpsuits,
uh-huh.
We basically sacrifice our individuality in that way. That'll be about the time that we give up private property, because let's face it, we all like our own stuff, you know?
Yeah, well, we do.
And we work hard for our stuff, and we, you know, we don't want anybody to take our stuff. You know, if somebody breaks in and takes our stuff, we call the cops, and they, you know, so that form of force, society's force, is able to come out and then, you know, take our complaint and hopefully investigate and find our stuff and bring it back. You know, that's always the hope that's the way our society works. So, you know, unless you change human nature a whole lot, there are some things that, you know, are going to be with us and private property.
Well, no, it's not about changing human nature.
Not property and fashion.
It's about, well, yeah, the silver jumpsuits, you know, I don't think so. But it's not about changing human nature. I think it's about changing the nature of humanity, if you will. If we're still existing in meat space, right, if we're still competing for land and so forth, then I agree that there's no model other than individual property to support the main goal, which is individual freedom and individual rights. I just think it's possible that when we're all living in the cloud, right, that it might not matter in the same way, and it might be implemented differently. That's all. I still think that the key is that everybody would get their stuff, but there's not as if you know what I mean, if everything is just like electrons, right? If Range Rovers can be handed out as freely as you can hit paste in your laptop today, that the issue won't be quite the driver that it is now. I guess that's my point. That it's not that human nature will change.
We'll all be able to build our own dystopia. I mean, our own utopia. Excuse me. And the future you're considering there. So yeah, even there though, human nature hasn't necessarily changed. We all get to, you know, be sexy, immortal billionaires.
Billionaires, yeah, exactly. I mean, what good is being a billionaire if you don't have billions? I mean, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I agree. I don't think human nature will change. I just think how we live might change in big ways, and some of this stuff might get implemented differently. But, hey, we're spending way too much time in utopia. Take us through the top movie dystopia companies. I thought that was a fun way to just kind of sum up how we entertain ourselves, really, with these visions of the world gone wrong. So talk to me about that.
I'm going to list off a couple of them, and I'd like you to see if you can name the movie this huge corporation that is a big player in this dystopia. Name the movie that it comes from.
Okay.
The first I've got is Omni Consumer Products.
Omni Consumer Products is that's
let me
not.
Give you a, let me give you a hint. Go by the initials. Omni Consumer Products.
OCP. I was thinking it's not the company in Terminator, so it must be the one in RoboCop.
RoboCop is it. Yeah,
okay.
OCP is mentioned. They call it OCP mostly in RoboCop. But,
oh, okay, okay.
It is Omni Consumer Products, and let me give you one that you probably of course the Soylent Corporation. You know.
Wait a minute. We don't still have that sound clip, do we?
I don't think we do.
Oh, too bad.
It's people. We
Stephen, we should always have some Charlton Heston queued up because we need it sometimes.
I need to. That's my bad. When Blog Talk Radio made an update recently, a little while back, we lost our sound files and I never reloaded them, and that's I should have. But okay, there you are. Soylent Green is the movie we're thinking of with Soylent Corporation. Okay,
yep.
How about Terrell Corporation?
That's Blade Runner, Terrell Corporation.
Yeah, Tyrell, yeah. More human than human.
Yeah.
I love this tagline underneath it describing, what their industries are into. Genetic engineering and temporary staffing. That's their.
There you go. That's their specialty. You see how those two go together?
That's right.
In that world, they actually do. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Soylent Green, right? It's funeral service and catering. You know, they
in that order.
Yeah, they provide both.
Anyway, let's see here. This is a newer one. Multinational United.
Multinational United. Was that the company in Moon?
No, that was the company in District 9.
Oh, District 9. Okay, right.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Let's talk about District 9. Is District 9 a dystopia?
Yeah, that's sort of interesting because really, what that was more of a present day, an alternate present day movie. So it wasn't looking really to the future. It was almost a parable of the South African townships.
It was a commentary about things that had really happened historically in South Africa. Although you got to say that District 9 itself was a dystopia. I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is not a place you would want to live.
Even if you were living in the hovel above the spaceship, that's not where you want to hang.
That was a nasty place. So,
okay.
What's the common thread here with all these companies? These are all companies in dystopias. What do they have in common?
I think that pretty much they are out for the almighty dollar without regard to morality at all, and so that's what I would say they have in common. How about you?
I would agree. I think the company in RoboCop These are the classic Lord Humongous, right? They've found a way to put themselves on top of the heap of misery. Now, I would say Soylent Corporation, in one sense, yeah, definitely that's what they're about. They've put themselves on top of the heap of misery. But on the other hand, as horrible as it sounds, for that world,
they're feeding the world.
Yeah, they found something that kind of works, I mean, it's...
well, the world's falling apart. How do we live as long as possible? Well, here's how we live as long as possible.
Exactly. Terrell Corporation, that's interesting, too, because to what extent is the world of Blade Runner a dystopia? On a scale from, Soylent Green, clearly that's a dystopic world, right? And then District 9, which really isn't. There's just some unfortunate stuff in there, and it's a bad company, Multinet. I mean, they're not nice. So I wonder if this is more a list of bad companies than just
bad companies in sci-fi movies, maybe.
Yeah.
But, I would say that there are levels of dystopias, and Blade Runner is not the worst by far. I mean,
right.
Mankind has made it to the stars in that future, and although the world is sort of a mess, depending on the ending you saw, if you get away from the cities, it wasn't so bad. And so, it wasn't the worst possible dystopia there.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing about dystopias in fiction is that they serve a purpose. I think utopias serve a purpose because they direct our thinking around the future in a positive way. When used properly, utopian ideas give us this vision of how things can be. Dystopias do the same thing. They give us this vision of how things can be if we're not careful. That's what a good dystopia is all about. And then there's some that are just dumb and they're fun anyway, like Planet of the Apes. Right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever going to be like that. I don't think that's a realistic warning, but it's entertaining anyway. At the time it was made.
Do you think mankind would be happier in a utopia or a slightly dysfunctional world that they could seek to improve?
Well, I think
I'm reminded of the let me give you the little speech from Agent Smith. Okay.
Okay.
He says in the Matrix movie, "Did you know that the first Matrix was designed to be a perfect human world where none suffered, where everyone would be happy? It was a disaster. No one would accept the program. Entire crops were lost. Some believed we lacked a programming language to describe your perfect world. But I believe that, as a species, human beings defined their reality through misery and suffering. The perfect world was a dream that your primitive cerebrum kept trying to wake up from, which is why the Matrix was redesigned to this, the peak of your civilization, and I say your civilization, because as soon as we started thinking for you, it really became our civilization, which is, of course, what this is all about." Of course, I can't say it half as cool as Hugo Weaving, but there you go. There's a little.
I thought it was well done. Well done. You were channeling Agent Smith there. Well, okay, first off, I just want to say I don't trust anything Agent Smith says, okay? Because he doesn't think our world smells good, and I think it smells okay most of the time.
It's the smell.
It's the smell. That's what I mean. There could be something there. There could be something there. Although I don't believe that we love misery. We fight hard for there not to be misery. We make ourselves miserable as a species. There's no question that sometimes it does seem that we go to huge lengths to make ourselves miserable. but most efforts, what I call the human imperative, most of human energy throughout the ages has actually been spent trying to eliminate misery, has been trying to increase happiness, to optimize the human experience. So I think that to go back to the way you phrased the question originally, I think that's exactly right. I think that irrespective of whether we'd be happier in a utopia or a slightly dysfunctional world, all we're ever going to be in is a slightly dysfunctional world. From where we sit right now, the world of 1,000 years from now, might look like a paradise beyond any measure and imagining. But I assure you that the people living there will see that as a slightly dysfunctional, very messed up kind of a place that they think they might get right one of these days. That's what I mean when I say that utopias you know, they look better at a distance. You know, you need to blur your vision just a bit to understand that a utopia has been achieved. And I think they're achieved in a practical way. Not you never get to the ideological perfect one. You never get to the truly perfect world that the machines tried to create for us in the first Matrix. Because I do think that's impossible. I think that striving for something better is what drives us. And if there's not anything better, if you can't imagine anything better, it's like you're done, right? Where do you go? So yeah, I think that actually we're surprisingly on almost exactly the same page once again, Stephen.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we are. I mean, it's you know, we always will take two steps forward, one step back. As you know, we come up with new things that are, and that have unintended consequences that we have to deal with. But the unintended consequences are not as bad as the problems we had before, and so we're always moving forward. And even though it's, we're having to deal with problems along the way. So it's at least that's been our experience in the last few hundred years, at least. So.
One interesting thing about dystopias, before we sign off, I meant to mention earlier, as you were going through the list, interesting in movies that the source of the misery is always a corporation. If you go back to dystopic literature, 1984 and so forth, the source of the misery was an all-powerful government. Interesting,
right.
that one idea got replaced by the other by Hollywood. You don't see too many of the all-powerful government implementations in movies, but boy, do you see evil corporations in movies. And
I would suggest that is just a demonstration of the left-leaning nature of Hollywood. But there you go.
Yep, entirely possible. It's also. I think it probably resonates for people who work for corporations in a lot of ways. It's like, well, it's more familiar to you. You know, you deal with the government a little bit. You deal with a corporation just about every day of your life. Not me. I happen to work for, you know, Sybase, so I'm perfectly happy. But I'm talking about, you know,
yeah,
people who work for companies
like
that we can't name. Yeah, exactly. Evil corporations. That's right. Okay, so I just wanted to throw that out there. What do we got going on music-wise this evening?
Well, we have a band that's returning to us tonight. It's Lato, I guess. It's L-A-T-O, however you choose to pronounce it. But the song is All Lit Up.
All Lit Up by Lato. Well, Stephen, this was great fun. I wish we had another hour to talk about this further. But you know what? Let's take another hour next week and talk about whatever's on our minds then.
That sounds good.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for putting the music together. Thank you all for being part of the show, everyone in the chat room and everyone listening live. And everyone listening to us via recording, thank you for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week at the regular time, assuming there's no power failures. And until then, live to see it. The night.
My heart is beating like a hammer.